Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Fred Report Technical Market Call for July 30th, 2015. We'll run through our stock and bond stuff so that we can get to my friend Dennis and MLPs. So we'll be fairly quick, but we will take questions on that before we start with Dennis. So first thing on stocks, golly, I hate to keep repeating myself, but what we're seeing here essentially is a market that's not going anywhere with still deteriorating technical indicators. And by deteriorating, let's give some examples. We all know or should know that we want to see the McClellan oscillator at plus 200 to signal escape velocity and a big breakout type move. Currently, the McClellan oscillator is at plus 9, and it's been negative for the whole week except for yesterday. So that indicator is failing. We also want to note that the expansion of new lows has continued. Obviously, we get new readings on Friday, but last week the new lows were at the highest level of the year. You know, if there are no change in these numbers and the market breaks down through 204 on the spider, we would expect 198 or lower and fairly quickly. What these things are saying is that risk management is key. Don't let stuff get out of hand on the downside, because in this kind of environment, the undercurrents of the market are suggesting that the path of least resistance is actually down. One of the things we've been asked about is biotechs. We mentioned before on the last rally in biotechs that they were going up on negative momentum. They've since come back. A break of IBB below 368 says that 310 could be challenged, and sector report readers will note that we have actually, as of a couple of weeks ago, lowered healthcare to an equal weight, at least in part because biotech was looking a little bit funky. Let's talk a bit about bonds. Bonds remain on a very small short-term buy signal. Our portfolio is doing okay versus treasuries. Remember, we sold DSUM, dim sum, a couple of weeks ago and bought PGX preferreds, which have a higher yield, and they look good. Our convert CWB look good, although, as we've mentioned in various meetings, you may want to use a mutual fund for that. Our favorite mutual fund is the Invesco mutual fund because it has a smaller management fee than Calamos. And, of course, we have PCY, which is emerging market bonds, and that looks like it's in a bottoming area, and BKLN bank loan, which is trading reasonably well and is floating rate. In the commodities, we are looking forward to our monthly readings, and we'll discuss those next week. But we would mention that Friday is the last trading day of the month. And so all of our seasonal trades, anyone who's in a seasonal trade along with us with oil, that trade should be sold as of Friday. Gold, you know, again, there were rumors of a big seller in August, the last trading day before notice day on the August contract is Friday. We don't expect much from gold before Friday. And that market is trading still a little worse than we would have thought. We're not in a huge hurry, but anyone who's holding gold here, we should wait at least until next week to see what happens with that. Let's talk about international for 1 second. Europe is favorable relative to some of the other markets, and our favorites there are still Switzerland, which is EWL, and Italy for speculative players, which is EWI. We are watching GXC and China with interest, but we do consider that that market is going to retest on GXC that 75 low sometime in the next 3 to 7 weeks, and make a new closing low per the forecast we had several weeks ago. And then we'll have to see what happens with that market, but we are concerned. At the same time, emerging markets are trading badly, you know, in support at 36.37, but trading badly, and we took a couple of those out of our portfolio models as well. Before we go on to Dennis and MLPs, are there any questions about anything we said? Jeff, anything, and then we'll get right to Dennis and MLPs.
Yeah, Fred, just to qualify something real quickly on
sure.
GXC. You talked about it going to new lows. I mean, effectively, it is at new lows right now, with the exception of you know, the one kind of gappy down day that took us down to, I'm just looking at the date right here. It's the,
say 75.
It was the 8th, and it closed at 74.62. And every other day, it's kind of like, I mean, basically, it intraday, it came down and kind of tested 78, which is where it's pretty damn close to right now. So, I mean, that's not much for a retest, correct?
That's not much, but we would still expect a break of that 74.60, or at least be aware that that could occur.
Okay,
and
so if it breaks that, then where's it going?
Then it could be going to 87.
On the downside.
It may not go to the downside.
Okay, good.
In other words, we may make a double bottom there. We would not expect any sort of major rally without a double bottom formation, is what we're saying. Obviously, if it keeps going, it can go to 60, but we would not be interested until we get a cutout or double bottom low. And we're looking at some of the other ETFs as well. You know, HAO, FXI, all those should do that sort of formation. But if any one of them does it, we're going to be looking for an opportunity to actually buy China for a trade to the upside.
Yeah, Fred, real quickly, and I'll turn it back to you. I read an article last night on Bloomberg on this guy who's known as being an even better short seller than Carson Block, who's Muddy Waters, who's the guy who's just nailed every China company after China company. And now that guy is actually calling for, like huge upside in China. He actually presented a really simple argument, which is that, you know, all these people didn't get in before, so now that it's corrected, like, all these individuals are going to want to come in now. So it's very interesting that, like, a pretty noted short seller who's done incredible on China is now taking the other angle and saying, hey, I actually want to be long China. So,
you know, that is interesting. I'm just going by the technical expectations, and that's where, you know, normally after the kind of downward momentum we've seen, you get a double bottom retest after 5 to 10 weeks. We've got an indication that should happen, and so that's what we're essentially looking for.
Okay. I'll find an article and send it to you, and maybe we attach it to the weekly.
Please do,
It's just a very interesting article, so I'll turn it back to you. That's the only thing I had.
Okay, cool. Dennis, are you on? And remember, Dennis, star 6.
Yes, I'm on.
Good,
I'm on.
Okay. Dennis, I think, and guys, everyone on the call, we have not rehearsed this. Dennis and I have not rehearsed at all, so bear with us. I guess what I'm going to do is, Dennis, if you would tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're on the call, I've got a couple of questions for you and that should get to what we're talking about, and then we'll throw the call open to any advisors that have MLP questions. So, Dennis, if you would take it away.
Yeah, certainly. I'm on at Fred's request because of my background working in the midstream business. I am a project attorney in the midstream business. I've been in the energy business in general for over 30 years, midstream in particular for 25 years, starting out with Occidental Petroleum, then went with its NGL spinoff in the 90s, a company called Trident, ended up becoming eventually Natural Gas Clearinghouse and NGC Corp, Dynegy, Targa Resources. Then I left there after many years with a chain of companies to open up the legal department here in Houston for Louis Dreyfus Highbridge Energy, who had made a major step into the midstream business at that time. Worked with them until they sold those assets off to Energy Transfer, and was with them for about 2 years after that sale, and then left them about 2 years ago. So I've been in solo practice since then. My background is project development as well as aspects of operations. And I will say I did do a little prep for this call, and I did have a conversation about the topic with a fairly significant executive in the business development realm of midstream, who's currently with a privately owned venture capital owned company. So he was able to speak more freely than often. But we spoke on an industry level, not to his company, about this particular issue about, you know, the concept that MLPs have some sort of not immunity, but at least they're not completely, they're somewhat sheltered from the commodity price swings. And when I raised that question with him and we had our conversation the other day, his response was rather emphatic how much he disagreed with that. And he's been in the business development project. So that's why I'm on, my background with the BD people in this world and project development, as well as going through, this business does tend to be cyclical. So over this 30 years, I've been through several cycles of the development phases, ups and downs in the business. So
yeah. Well, what Dennis is saying essentially is that people in the industry are disagreeing with the Wall Street analysts. We're getting a very simple answer from most of our Wall Street fundamental analysts, which say there is no correlation with the price of oil. But as a technician, all you have to do is look at the charts and see that they are correlated. So what Dennis is going to do is talk about a couple of ways that those correlations can actually arise and why they are actually correlated in some instances. So, Dennis, if you would give us a little bit of enlightenment on why those correlations actually can exist.
Sure. And unlike any analyst making those kind of generalizations, I will say these aren't generalizations. It does depend on the company, their asset portfolio, and where they are in their growth curve. You know, they're acquiring new assets, building new projects, whatever. But the some of the reasons this is happening is as you go through these cycles of development, and the MLP world has, in fact, in some ways, you know, when we were back in the 80s and 90s and MLPs were not as big, the cycles were substantial because some of the companies did have more exposure, midstream companies, they had keep all contracts, BTU keep all contracts, more percent of proceeds contracts that clearly expose them more to this. They've tried to move that off, and they have tried to do that in many instances. It's been pretty successful to try to move it, but that doesn't mean they've done that entirely. And as you go through this project cycle, a few years ago, about three or four years ago, there was a substantial pent-up capacity demand for pipelines, terminals, fractionators, especially for LPG product in the Gulf Coast area. And at that time, the midstream companies were able to, there was enough demand, they were able to make demand to get the kind of contracts that apparently the fundamental analysts, they think all their contracts are like, which is throughput agreements, you know, with minimum throughput guarantees, which is what, as a midstream company, you try to look for, because you're not going to be getting the big returns like an E&P company does. So you want to have some guarantees from the customer that they are going to ship, so they got a guaranteed minimum throughput. You're going to want to get a percentage of your capacity on the new project contracted up in that way. The problem was about 3 years ago, everybody was chasing projects. It got extremely competitive. And a lot of people, they wanted to really build their balance sheet, show that they were busy to the investor world building new projects. And a lot of them started taking projects on where they did not have, they might have limited throughput guarantees or no throughput guarantees. And what exposes them then, clearly, is if the producer does not flow, they will not have the toll. They won't be able to collect the toll for the use of the facilities. So even the contract on the face looks like it's a utility-type contract with throughput payments. The exposures will the producer produce? Because if you don't have enough minimum throughput guarantees, then you're more price exposed. So, and that was, there's not, you can't make a generalization that that happened generally in smaller, higher-risk companies or larger companies. The companies all across the spectrum took those kind of project risks when they were chasing these projects, and that's gone on for the last couple of years. So the only way you can really analyze this, frankly, is what I've done many times in representing buyers. Of course, we get to go into a data room and look at the contract mix. And the business development guys, the M&A guys, will get their spreadsheets out, and they'll analyze what percentage of contracts are, percent of proceeds, how much throughput guarantee is guaranteed and at what rates, this type of thing, and they can build a model and analyze it. The problem is that kind of information just isn't publicly available, you know, to investors or analysts. So that's the difficulty in making a broad statement that's saying they're price protected, is because depending on the company, depending on how they chase the projects, they may or may not be price protected. So.
Right, and it's individual contracts, and a Wall Street fundamental analyst is not going to get access to that. And,
right.
Dennis, you know, when in my experience dealing with investor relations, which as a technical analyst is limited, obviously when you're talking to a Wall Street analyst, you put you tell the truth, but you do kind of put the best possible spin on things, don't you?
Oh, for certain. And I'm sure if you dig in their disclosures, there'll be some comments, and there's usually some footnotes that they have a certain amount of capacity rights, you know, that are not guaranteed, that type of thing. It just depends on the company. But you're not – the problem is there's no way to know the level of risk was actually crunching the numbers, and you just have to have a lot of inside, you know, company data to do that. And the only people that see the people in the company or people – we're having an auction process and somebody's getting to do due diligence.
Okay. Very good. So I guess what Dennis is saying is, you know, it's on a per company basis, but there's definitely a lot more risk and commodity risk in possibly all of these companies than anyone on Wall Street currently believes. And that's why the prices are correlated to the price of oil, in that, you know, some of the guys trading these things know that that type of contractual risk exists. I'm going to open the call to some questions for Dennis now. I know this is sort of a surprise. We didn't publicize this call as much as we should have probably, but does anybody on the call have any questions for Dennis about the contract process or how all this stuff works with MLPs? And if not, that's fine. Very good.
Hey, Brandon. Yep.
Hey, Kip, how are you? Yeah.
I'd like to ask the gentleman about if he noticed that this morning, Linn Energy, LNCOLINE, they completely cut their distribution to zero until the commodity seasonality seems to end, at least over $50, I think is what they said off the record. Did he have any comment on that?
No, I mean, I'm not in a position to comment on specific companies, but that's not surprising to me, and I don't know what their asset mix is or project mix is, but that's what is surprising, because if you're in the business doing BD work, you know, in project development, you know price affects the project flow, and it certainly affects, you know, what the capacity needs are, you know, and it also is very locations, but I forgot to mention this, it is location sensitive too, depending on where you are, where the constraints are, and what your competition is locally.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, in other words,
I mean,
guys,
I think it goes to prove the point, so, yeah.
Yeah, more complicated than just a one-liner saying we don't have any price exposure, which is what I got from one Wall Street analyst.
Yeah, that if you said that to people internally in the business, they would, they would not agree with that. I'll just say that. They would not agree with that statement in any way.
Right. Okay. good. Any other questions for Dennis? Okay. Then, Dennis, thank you very much, and we will enjoy sending you the Fred Report for a year for free. And obviously, if we have any other MLP questions, we'll come back to you. That was a very nice, cogent review, and thank you. Go on and have a good morning. Get some breakfast tacos.
All right. Thank
you. Fred.
Already done,
yes,
as a matter of fact. All right.
Fred.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.
Fred, this is Mark Speth in Tulsa. We let that guy off the hook too quick. There's a bunch of questions, I bet.
Ah, okay. Well, you know what? We can always bring him back at another time and publicize that we're going to bring him back. We, frankly, I had a little bit of a miscommunication on Monday. We were going to put this on. But, Mark, I mean,
I'm actually still on, Fred. I didn't hang up.
Oh, good. Okay. Then,
I'm here in Tulsa. Just a couple of questions. I know you can't comment directly, but I'm going to ask you directly. Do you see this Williams and ETE deal getting done? And then what do you see just in general out there on those type of transactions, the NGLS, these other candidates for either a roll-up, consolidation in the industry, but specifically more on the Williams.
Yeah, again, I'm not an analyst, and I certainly avoid commenting, especially on my ex-employer, which is Energy Transfer, other than to say that Kelsey Warren's very determined when he decides to do something. He tends to not back off. He and Mackie both, the president, you know, they're pretty tenacious guys. And, you know, that's just my experience with them personally. But I would say that there is one thing I think that there's been some discussion in the press about is, and I can't comment, Fred, maybe you can, that there apparently is some philosophical difference here between the role of the GP, investing in GP and keeping it separate, and that's part of the disconnect between Williams and Energy Transfer. So, I can't comment on the investment aspect of it, but that is a financial and management issue philosophy that they apparently have different. So far as consolidation in the industry, my experience is it always happens. I mean, when you go through these cycles, you start to hit this down cycle, and you're going to hit some companies that have more of this exposure with, they don't have sufficient minimum throughput fees flowing, or the other risk, of course, is they went into a field with particularly, immature producing companies. And as they say, a guarantee is only as good as a balance sheet behind it. You could have some cases where you have minimum throughput guarantees on projects where the producers, aren't producing enough, making enough to meet the guarantees. So as you see isolated situations like that, you certainly see companies buying things up. A lot of times it first starts with organic acquisitions that are not on the high merger level. There's an aspect of the NGL business and the midstream in particular that's extremely hard to analyze, but where you have assets and where somebody sits the assets, you have a substantial value differential for a particular asset that's on the block to sell. You can have one company that can do a lot more with it than another company could. So as things go down in the down cycle, I definitely would not be surprised to see a lot of consolidation, first the assets and then up at the higher level. That wouldn't be surprising to me because that's what's happened in the past. So.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good. And Mark, by the way, Dennis is from Tulsa originally, so I'm surprised he didn't mention that. But other
started
questions for Dennis.
There,
Yeah, that's okay. Other questions for Dennis. I know this is a little bit different than our normal calls, but go ahead.
Yeah, this is Joe in Pepper Pike.
Hey, how are you, Joe?
I'm doing real well. My question is on the risk here. Is it a function of the size of the companies, or are they all basically at the same level of risk?
I wouldn't say either one. I wouldn't say they're all at the same level of risk. Obviously, if you have a bigger asset base, you can sustain more risk. But there is, I think I mentioned before, you cannot say that this tended to happen more in the smaller companies versus the larger companies. It depended on the management personalities at the time as whether they really wanted to chase projects and build assets, so they took higher risk. And like I said, I had the conversation with my friend, the business development representative of the business, and he said it happened in all companies at all different tiers, startups to the big ones. It's spread all over the place, these high-risk projects where they didn't get enough, throughput guarantees. So now I don't think you can say there's a broad, there's no way you can categorize it by size or even age, of company. So,
Sorry, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. I had one thought, and that would be a way that you might be able to determine this would be to look at the time that the contracts were acquired. And obviously, if oil was near its highs and they suddenly acquire a lot of contracts, you could infer but not know that those were riskier contracts.
Yeah, my thinking was based on geographies, things that have been in place for longer probably have contracts that are more settled because you're going to get throughput from those areas that have been drilled out pretty well.
Well, that's certainly the case because for one thing, and you're right, geography makes a difference, and I'd say, I think the stuff that, and that kind of relates to what Fred says about the time development, not just the price correlation, but when everybody was is chasing, Marcellus or Bakken projects all at the same time, then you have more likely to have seen this have occurred, so there could be some geographic aspect. I would agree with that. And the more mature areas, if they have a base load of production that can carry the existing infrastructure and the added projects, there might be some lower risk there. So the problem is it's numbers. How much of that is the company's portfolio? Did they take a huge step out into Marcellus and Bakken, even though they've got a big, big base in Permian already? Obviously that spreads the risk, but the hard thing is quantifying it. So.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Other questions for Dennis?
Offer. Wells Fargo Advisors offers access to a
Hi, Fred. This is Alan. Hey, Alan, how are you?
Shoot, I'm great. Thank you so much for setting this up. This is just great information. My only problem is that now all of a sudden it's as though I'm needing to become more like an analyst, and I really feel ill at ease moving into that role. So is there a method or a series of questions or positioning that we could utilize going to analysts to kind of pin them down on which companies might be more exposed and those that might be less so?
Let me try to answer that, and then Dennis will chime in on my answer. Okay. The short answer to me would seem to be that there's no way that the analyst can actually get the information on the individual contracts. What we are seeing, though, is, and the feeling I wanted people to get from this conversation is, there is more risk and oil price risk to these MLPs than we have been told. Okay. One of the things that happens to us on Wall Street when things go wrong is we get a case of collective blindness, and then all of a sudden our eyes are open, but the prices are usually down. When a technician sees that sort of divergence between what is going on in the marketplace and what people say should be going on, first of all, I've learned over time that the answer is the market is right and what people say should be happening is in most cases wrong. And so I start to look for a reason for why that could be. And I think that what Dennis essentially is supplying us is the reason that that could be. So, in other words, I think there's still a little bit more risk in these MLPs on a price basis. Because, Dennis, correct me if I'm wrong, if prices just stay here and don't go up, there's still price risk.
Yes. I mean, the point is, you know, some of the producers, it depends on what their sunk cost is and what the production cost is. It just depends on the phase of the project, how well drilled is the field that is feeding the project in question. To the first question, you know, I would tend to agree with what Fred says. It's just there's so many variables and so many dynamics here, it'd be extremely hard to quantify it. I mean, you'd almost have to ask. They're very big on issuing, you know, releases about our projects, you know. And I'd say the only thing I could think of you do is you can query them, okay, how much of this project is supported by guaranteed throughput contracts, you know, and what kind of guarantee, what kind of percentage are you guys getting on guaranteed throughput contracts? Now, my experience is they are not going to tell you their internal rate of return on these projects. You know, they like to talk about the projects, but they get that rate of return is. The other question is, what are the assumptions in that rate of return? They anything they might give maybe based on their judgment about who's going to really flow and flow how much, you know, regardless of what the throughput guarantees are. I mean, that's the only thing. But that's the big problem is, like Fred says, unless you actually see the contracts for the projects, it's awfully hard, you know, to know what the real risk is, because they can generalize and say, yeah, it's a minimum throughput contract, but there might be another clause in the contract that gives the person the right to pay a penalty and get out of the throughput. There's all sorts of little tweaks they can do these contracts to make them, you know, a little less strong, you know. In both ways. I mean, back when it was really tight in capacity, back about 3 years ago, not only were you getting, I mean, I was involved in Energy Transfer right after they bought the midstream assets from Louis-Dreyfus. It was so tight then, there were companies and competitors that were getting not just minimum throughput fees, they were getting customers willing to kick in aid in construction payments, which is capital contributions to build the facilities that they would never get back just to get the capacity built, you know. So, it's just the problem is it's all over the map, you know, and quantifying it is, to me, very difficult. So,
okay. Alan, I hope that answers your question.
Does it? I mean, that's the main thing is, yeah, I agree with Fred. Is that the issue is the assumption is incorrect to say there's no price risk for these kind of companies, yeah. So.
Fred?
Yes, sir.
It sounds like if we could get the analysts to do it, it would be analyst pressure on the companies to identify how old the contracts are, how many are older than 3 years, and to try to pressure the companies to give feedback on the throughput guarantees and the clauses. It doesn't sound like if an analyst just asked the one question by himself, the company's probably not going to be real keen to answer. But if you did get the entire analyst community putting a little pressure on them, do you think you've got more potential to get honest feedback from the companies?
Dennis, that's a Dennis question, not a Fred question. I think that's probably true.
I meant it for Dennis. Excuse me.
Yeah.
That psychology, I hate to guess. really, it'd be tough. And again,
well, and the fact
there's
is,
not
Dennis,
be,
from what you're, sorry, from what you're saying,
well,
Dennis, they don't
metric
have to reveal that.
Disclose.
Yeah.
No, and a lot of that stuff is very confidential, closely held stuff. Is how did they get that deal? You know, now some of these guys, like the one I was talking to, yesterday in preparation for this call, they competed with these companies that took deals, so they have a good general idea about where the deal went. And he was with one of these companies that's, is more conservative, and they walked from those deals. They didn't take them, because he said, we won't do, unless I'm going to get an E&P type of return, I'm not going to take a flat price risk on production. You know, why should I do that? You know, so.
Thank you.
Yeah, Steve, any other questions? I know you actually know something about contracts. Other questions for Dennis? Any questions for Fred? Very good. Then let's say going once.
Hey, Fred.
Hey, Fred, it's Paul.
Paul.
How are you?
Paul first. Good, Paul.
Real quick, can you just give me a quick comment on LMT, Liquid Mary Tom?
Liquid Mary Tom, surely. Let's bring that up. LMT. That's Lockheed Martin. And you're still fine on that as long as you stay trading-wise above 205 and investment-wise above 200. That's a decent-looking chart short-term. Let's take a look at the longer-term very quickly. It's still a breakout, but you want to hold 198, the low of this week. But it looks
fine. Very
good.
Thank you.
Surely. And we had one other question, it sounds like, coming in.
Hey, Fred, it's John.
John, how
Fred's
are
John.
You?
I'm fine. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Thanks for setting that up. Quick on a stock. Kappa Edward Yellow William.
Kappa Edward Yellow William. Okay. Currently trading on the weekly chart at 855 and... it's very slightly positive, but nothing to write home about. And below 740, ouch.
Okay. Perfect. Thanks. So we need to get together for lunch soon.
Yeah, absolutely, after August 8.
Okay, I'll drop you an email.
Got it.
Hey, Fred, Bob Sauer, I came in late on BABA. Could you just comment on that as
sure.
Short term?
Bob, it is still holding, and I'm going to call you after the call. It is still holding. You might see a test to 76 if China retests, but it's basically still holding, and it's a base on the weekly chart. Let me take one quick look at something. The daily chart makes it look like, unless we hold this 79 to 79.50 area, that, Bob, you are going to get a retest. There's a gap at 78. Watch if it stops there.
Okay. Thanks, Fred.
Sure.
Hi, Fred. It's Joseph.
Joseph, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks. Apropos your conversation this morning, can you take a look at the 1,000-pound gorilla at KMI?
KMI. Kinder Morgan. That on the daily chart is showing a couple little bottoming signs, and on the weekly chart, you've got a lot of support between 35 and 33. It's oversold enough that if it does some basing action and the weekly stochastic turns up, that is probably going to be a decent shot here.
Thanks.
Hey, Fred, it's Alan again.
Yes, sir, Alan.
Sierra, Lima, Charlie, Alpha, please.
Sierra, Lima, Charlie, Alpha. And, of course, I typed that in wrong. Sierra, Lima, Charlie, Alpha. Silica.
Yes.
You've actually got a nice little short-term bottom and an outside week on the weekly chart. Again, you can buy this. Your risk is that it starts exceeding the lows of this week. But otherwise, this is looking good and looking like a test of 28 or so.
Very good. Thank you.
Other questions for me or Dennis? And I want to, by the way, send thanks on behalf of the Fred Report and everyone on the call to Dennis. That was a masterful exposition in terms of these MLPs. Going once, any other questions? Going
hey,
once?
Hey, Fred, Jeff, just one quick question for you.
Sure, Jeff.
On gold and GLD, it's really going back and forth here right around the 105 level. Thoughts?
You know, the only thing I would say is it's oversold enough to make a double bottom in this 103 to 105 area. The real fun is going to be next week when the August contract goes to notice. And let me very quickly again explain what goes to notice means. After the 1st of August, the last day of trading in July, you can be assigned to either take delivery or receive delivery of physical gold. You get a notice from the exchange that you have been assigned, okay? And once you get that notice, there's no way out. You are taking or making delivery. Now, in the commodities world nowadays, when they say you're taking delivery, it does not mean they're going to drive by your house and give you 10,000 bars of gold. What it does mean, though, is you're going to have additional expenses, warehouse expenses, that sort of stuff. So most traders and most hedgers try to stay away from notice unless they want to deliver or take delivery. We had been told a rumor, and again, I emphasize rumor, not fact, but rumor, that there was a seller in the August contract that did not want to get involved in delivery, in any aspect of delivery. The risk that that seller, well, put it this way, if the seller isn't through by Friday afternoon, he's at risk of taking that delivery or making delivery. So based on that, I kind of like gold here, but we won't know if there's anything dramatic going to happen tomorrow until tomorrow is over. And then we'll see if we can get a rally when the December contract starts to be the front month, which is the most actively traded contract that doesn't have the delivery aspects to it. So my guess is you're going to see a bounce next week as December comes in, but we don't really know that. And tomorrow you could see one more zap of selling. Other questions? Very good. Again, going once, going twice. Very good. This will end the Fred Report technical market call for July 30th. Unbelievable, July 30th, 2015. We'll see everyone again next week, and thank you.